Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was goodbye President Bush and hello Team Obama this week in Washington, heroics on the Hudson and woe in Gaza. At the podium in the White House last night, it was President Bush. Last time, last goodbye.
And so, my fellow Americans, for the final time, good night. May God bless this House and our next president.
Obama's nominees in hearings all over. Attorney General nominee Eric Holder minced no words on waterboarding.
We prosecuted our own soldiers for using it in Vietnam. I agree with you, Mr. Chairman, waterboarding is torture.
And in Gaza, gunfire and grief. This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What do you see coming and going in Washington, in the world? Joining us today from Dallas, Texas, is our old friend Bill McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
With us from Washington, we welcome Michelle Cottle, senior editor at The New Republic. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Bill. And welcome, Michelle.
Thanks.
Hello, everybody. It was goodbye to President Bush this week. Let's listen to just a little bit of him last night in the, the East Room of the White House.
As the years passed, most Americans were able to return to life much as it had been before 9/11. But I never did. Every morning, I received a briefing on the threats to our nation. I vow to do everything in my power to keep us safe.
And, said President Bush last night, I did. 7 years, no attack, lots of goodbyes in this week. Bill McKenzie, one of them was with you and a couple of your colleagues at the Dallas Morning News in the Oval Office within this last week. You've known President Bush for a long time. How do you look at him as he prepares to walk out that door, maybe for the last time, Bill?
Well, that's right. I was struck last night watching that speech and contrasting that to when he came in December of 01. You remember he gave that speech in the well of the Texas House where he went up there with his pal Pete Laney and talked about how we wanted to have this bipartisan model that we used here in Texas. Then watching him go out last night, you know, he was spent. And I guess that's the way these presidencies are. At the end, you have nothing left. And that's really the way it kind of struck me. Now, when we interviewed him last Thursday, he was very relaxed. He was very energetic. I found him the guy that I first knew back in 1992 and covered in, you know, very closely in the 94 campaign. And from thereafter, he was you could just talk with him. You could argue with him. You could push back with him. He didn't take offense. He understood why people disagreed with him. He was articulate. He went for 75 minutes. He didn't have any of the defensiveness that sometimes comes through in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote this week. I really wonder if it's possible for presidents the modern presidents to really reveal themselves, because he was unable to do that. He was unable to show that side of himself that those of us who knew him and knew him well down here saw all the time. And by that, I mean a lot of Democrats who really liked him.
And you liked him, Bill, and you describe him as a kind of amiable, humble, articulate, unifying George W. Bush. Why do you think that's not what the country has seen for much of this last 8 years?
Well, what he said to that was, part of it were because of decisions he made about war, and by that, it not only going to war, but also the things that came out around it, whether that is going to be detainees, torture, Guantanamo. So I think that's part of it. I think also you saw it last night. 9/11 was it for this guy. I mean, that really was a thing that was very personal to him, and I think you could argue, and I have argued, I think to some extent he personalized it too much. However, you know, as you're sitting there in the Oval Office and as he's talking in other venues, you realize you are the guy. You're the guy whose responsibility is to protect the United States from another attack. And I think he successfully did that. And it wasn't just something that was easy to do. It required Homeland Security Department. It required running down intelligence leads and money trails and all these things. That is not inconsequential. Think what that would have done to our economy if we'd been attacked again. You know, we're looking at where we are today. Wow. Could you imagine if we'd been hit again?
Well, you know, we weren't. And we're in pretty rough shape on the economy today. But you wrote on Monday in the morning news in Dallas, Bill, he allowed Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, and Don Rumsfeld to shift his administration's tone from his collegial Austin approach. That gone. Michelle Cottle, I'm sure you've been watching him in the press conference and again last night, many venues in recent weeks. Your thoughts as President Bush heads for the door, Michelle?
Well, I agree with Bill that he looked a little different than we've been used to seeing him. I mean, he looked almost sheepish, I mean, kind of shrunken by the whole experience. But that said, he sounded about the same in terms of kind of what he was saying. It was almost as though he was cheering himself for having made the tough decisions. I mean, for all that has gone on and for all of the criticism and for all of the mistakes that have been made by this administration, you still get the feeling that Bush is pretty confident that he will be vindicated by history. And if not, then it's just because people don't understand kind of what he had to do. He stuck to his guns. He followed his conscience. If people don't like it, they, you know, so be it. And I think that's basically how he's leaving office. He, as he put it, he experienced setbacks. You know, it's not even mistakes were made. It's disappointments were experienced or disappointments were had. It's not entirely clear that he is willing to admit that some of those disappointments can be laid at his doorstep.
Jack Beatty, confident that he'll be that he'll be lauded at some point by history. Is that reality-based confidence, Jack?
I doubt it. You know, perhaps no American president has done such harm to America. You know, possibly he deceived himself, but certainly he deceived his country into an unnecessary war with, 4,500 American and 100,000 Iraqi unnecessary deaths. He dishonored the country everywhere by approving torture and by creating those place names of American shame, Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. At home, lawlessly spied on Americans, abjectly let big oil shape his energy policy, shamelessly turned the Justice Department into a political chop shop, stood by while New Orleans sank, blithely dismissed warnings about the impending financial catastrophe. And for all this, he has taken no responsibility. You know, Mao was once asked his view of the French Revolution. He said, it's too early to tell. So it's perhaps too early to tell how historians will rank Bush or whether they will rank him as the worst president, but certainly he will rank among the worst.
Michelle, I hear you there.
Oh, that was Bill.
Oh, sorry, Bill. yes, in Dallas, Bill. Yes, yes, sir.
I'm getting out of my seat. Okay. I can tell Jack and I are going to have a long two-hour dinner sometime.
Yeah.
What about this? Look at No Child Left Behind. Look at the Obscure America Competes Act, which was a very bipartisan thing. Look at the Higher Education Act. Look at the expansion of Pell Grants. All of those things form our response to the great challenge that Tom Friedman put in his book, that the world is flat and we're looking at India and China getting ready to clean our clock when it comes to math, science, engineers, and being the technology leader. Well, all of those initiatives I just talked were very bipartisan. They were very Bush-led, and they are our response to trying to deal with India and China trying to become our technology leader. I don't think that is a huge, giant failure. You look at 39 out of 43 million Americans have taken this prescription drug benefit. I don't think that's really a big, giant failure. You look at the his attempt. I agree he failed. But look what he tried to do on immigration. He tried to challenge his party and challenge the nation to come up with a fair, compassionate immigration policy, which I think Obama will get. And when it does, it'll be kind of like LBJ being able to get the civil rights initiatives passed. After, you know, it was handed off to him from Jack Kennedy's year. So I think he laid the predicate there. I think that's very significant.
I think what we're talking about here, though, is I don't think that we can talk about Bush in terms of pure evil. No one's suggesting that he didn't do anything right. I mean, there's the AIDS initiatives that he looked into. But what we're talking about here and what Jack was going through was a list of things that fall into a particular area. You know, he was incredibly destructive in terms of having the Justice Department politicized. And as far as his foreign policy or his kind of homeland security approaches, yes, in some ways you can say he kept the country safe. But if you're looking at long term, he did tremendous damage. I mean, even his own intelligence agencies have said that we're in worse shape for the long term than we were before he started all this. So I think in those particular areas, it may just be that he was either heavily influenced by people who took him in a different direction, or he didn't know enough to kind of know where he was being taken. You know, this isn't an either or. I mean, he can have done some good things, but he was also a complete abject disaster in a lot of areas.
I've got to ask Mercy on the Bush front, because the future is rushing at us, and all kinds of Obama people on Capitol Hill this week in hearings. Michelle, do you see the ship of state making a, I don't know, 180-degree turn here? Pragmatist Obama splitting the difference? Is this a centrist guy? Or do you see in the testimony you heard this week, Michelle, a whole new day coming up with Obama?
Well, I think in foreign policy, he is not going hard left. I mean, even people on the right have been kind of comforted by the idea that he's got a lot of centrists in there. You know, Hillary Clinton, Jim Jones, keeping Bush's guys around. I think that in that way, he will take a very pragmatic approach. He is not going to be a hardcore lefty. You know, but that said, he will have significant differences on things like rendition, torture, and enough that I think he's going to be able to restore some of the credibility. So I think he's not going to be the right's nightmare when they were talking about liberal boogeyman, but he is going to make some substantive changes.
Well, there it goes. Jack, new day coming up. Do you see it?
Well, already we're seeing it. In my Elections Have Consequences file this week, I have 4 million more children covered by health insurance under the SHIP program.
Yep.
And we have the statement from Attorney General Designee Holder, waterboarding is torture.
Simple as that.
Simple as that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Bush says farewell. Hillary and Holder on the Hill. 1,000-plus dead in Gaza, and a plane goes down easy, thank heavens, in the Hudson River. Jack Beatty's here. Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News is with us. And Michelle Cottle of the New Republic, senior editor there. Hillary Clinton on Capitol Hill this week for her confirmation hearings as Secretary of State. Here she is talking about being time for America to use smart power.
We must use what has been called smart power, the full range of tools at our disposal, diplomatic, economic, military, political, legal, and cultural, picking the right tool or combination of tools for each situation. With smart power, diplomacy will be the vanguard of our foreign policy.
Smart power, her buzz phrase there, as opposed to, well, it kind of answers itself. Let's go to our callers in Ithaca, New York. Faye, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. I do hope that we do use diplomacy and use more of our hearts than our military. The thing that I wanted to share with you today is just I'm so upset with what's happening in Gaza. And the thoughts that I wanted to just say is that it's so disproportionate. I mean, in terms of what Israel is doing to Gaza, I mean, it's unacceptable. It's inhumane. And the roots of these issues are very, very deep, and they're historically very long. But it just doesn't justify bombing a UN building where there's all these children there. I was watching the news, and a UN representative did say there were no fires shot from that building, and there was no excuse for that building to have been shot. Journalists are not allowed into Gaza. They weren't allowed into Gaza for a long time, which laid the foundation for what has happened. This is happening right before the inauguration. It's a last-minute pitch to do this kind of work, and Israel's behavior is unacceptable.
Faye, we've got the perspective, and we've got more on this subject. Let me turn to one more here. Sunderland, Massachusetts, and Kathy. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I agree with the woman from Ithaca. Unfortunately, I think that the Bush administration encouraged the most hardline people in Israel, and I think they've made the peace process infinitely more complex.
Kathy, I'll turn to our panel on both those perspectives. Let's hear a little tape here first. Ban Ki-moon, UN Secretary General in Israel, as Israel hit the big UN headquarters there with the food warehouse and a lot of people as well, expressing he called for a unilateral Israeli ceasefire this week, expressed disappointment with that Israeli strike on the UN compound in Gaza.
The UN compound in Gaza has been shelled again. I conveyed my strong protest and outreach to the defense minister and the foreign minister and demanded a full explanation.
Outrage, the word there from UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in Israel as bombs fell on the UN headquarters in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert met with him yesterday, talked about that shelling of the headquarters, insisted that Israeli forces were targeting Hamas militants in the compound or on it, but also apologized for the attack.
I'm very sorry, although, as I said, the Israeli forces were attacked, and as it happened, the response was very harsh, and I'm very sorry.
Israeli Prime Minister there yesterday. Bill McKenzie, it is indeed hard to watch. 1,100 or so casualties in Gaza now, maybe 700 of them civilians, lots of women and children. Whatever the agenda, this is excruciating to watch.
Right. Well, like the situation, I think my answer is complex. Yes, I agree with the caller from Ithaca that this is disproportionate. Israel really, for its own sake, needs to pull back. No question there. And you don't just want to bludgeon them into nothing. However, you know, Israel was the one that was attacked by Gaza. And if you look at you read a lot of what's going on there, it's very clear Hamas doesn't want to have Israel there. And if you look at there was a front page story in The New York Times a couple of weeks ago as this started about folks from Hamas who are going into hospitals in Gaza and attacking Palestinians who they thought had been too friendly to Israelis, right in front of the eyes of children and other people, and saying they deserve this. So, you know, look, you know, we aren't talking about guys who are necessarily interested in peace themselves. And if you look at what Abbas and other more moderate Palestinians are saying, they were telling them, don't do this. This is crazy. This is going to be self-defeating. So I agree it's disproportionate. I do think Israel had a right to respond, and I think we need to remember that the Palestinians leading in Hamas are leading this. They're not interested in peace either.
Jack Beatty, it's no peace rally over there, but oh, for a better way.
Oh, for a better way. You know, Thomas Friedman wrote this week, quote, "In Gaza, I still can't tell if Israel is trying to eradicate Hamas or trying to, quote, educate Hamas by inflicting a heavy death toll on Hamas militants and heavy pain on the Gaza population," end quote. Well, heavy pain on a population to get its government to change, that's called terrorism. And it's collective punishment. And that's one side of it. And then on the other side, look what has happened to our government. Prime Minister Olmert boasted that he called President Bush and got President Bush to get Condoleezza Rice at the UN to back away from a resolution she had spent 3 days working on, that she had, quote, in his words, cooked up, organized, formulated, and maneuvered. And he said, and she was left, this is Olmert, and she was left pretty embarrassed, abstaining on a draft resolution she organized herself.
Meanwhile, he sort of said he was laying down the law with the American president.
He was laying down the law with
the
American president.
But the State Department denies all this, of course.
Of course. And then in the House, 390-5, a resolution that could have been written by the Israeli government. In the Senate, a unanimous voice vote that could have been written on a resolution that could have been written in Israel. You know, we have to have our government be somewhat independent. The Daniel Levy, a former Israeli peace negotiator, said of this Olmert business, "This is terrible for the United States. This confirms every assumption they have in the Arab world about the tail wagging the dog."
Michelle Cuttle, I want to ask you about bin Laden, who emerged again this week, audio tape out on Wednesday, calling for Muslims to fight back. Jihad was his word against Israel in the offensive in the Gaza Strip. It's in Arabic here. I'll translate a bit.
Al-General al-Britani Gulubasha
Bin Laden's voice, I mean, I'm reading this translation, I can't say I'm fluent. Our brothers in Palestine, you've suffered a lot. The Muslims sympathize with you in what they see and hear. We, the Mujahideen, sympathize with you. Our fate is tied to yours in fighting the Crusader Zionist Coalition and fighting until victory or martyrdom. American authorities saying, yes, indeed, it looks like it is Bin Laden. What do you make of the overall effect of what we've seen? And are we finally... with everything that's gone down and the inauguration coming, does it look like we're approaching a ceasefire, Michelle?
Oh, God. And certainly, I think what we're seeing here is Bin Laden every once in a while needs to remind everyone that he's still around. You know, there are always rumors that he's, you know, died or been driven out of power or whatever. But, you know, he wants to pop up, and the Palestinian cause has always been a favorite flag to wave. You know, there is some thought that... Israel did this because it was the waning days of the Bush administration, and they knew they had 100% support from the Bushies. Now, as far as the ceasefire, every day there's new kind of hope or talk of that there's going to be a ceasefire. But, you know, it's going to be a temporary situation, and this is going to pop up again. So this is going to be probably foreign policy issue, if not number one, then pretty close to it when the new administration takes over on Tuesday. And Hillary's already pretty much made it clear that she sees this as a top priority. This is not going away. It's just the most complex thing imaginable. The smartest thing I think I've seen written on it lately was Jack's colleague Jeffrey Goldberg talking about this. You know, for all of the bad ill will that Israel has, you know, gleaned from this, that was entirely Hamas's goal. They were suffering in popularity. They had to do something. So the best way to do this is to have Israel attack, and everybody rallies around and says, oh, this is disproportionate. But you're never going to bomb Hamas out of its position, and you're also not going to negotiate directly with them. I think Jeffrey's position was that you're going to have to get Fatah involved in all this, and this is going to have to be one of those things where you wind up almost splitting the Palestinians into different groups that are going to deal with each other instead of having direct Israel negotiations.
Though whether Fatah still has the standing after all this and Hamas in the limelight, an open question. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina, and Floyd. Floyd, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Very well, sir. What do you think?
Well, you know, I believe that we're putting too much emphasis as the American people on these wars, and the reason why is because, you know, I believe that we're putting our troops at danger. You know, these wars that are being fought, these are wars that were even talked about in the Bible, the everlasting. And, you know, why are we putting so much emphasis on, you know, these wars? I mean,
when you say these wars, Floyd, what are you talking? Do you mean Israel, Gaza, the Middle East,
or with the war in Gaza, with the Israelis, different things like that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I just believe that we should be focusing more on what's going on in the United States with the economy. And, you know, we have so much trouble here, you know, and I just believe that we're putting, you know, our troops at risk if we continue to, you know, take troops into these different countries to fight a war that really doesn't have anything to do with us, I believe.
Floyd, let us go straight to that. Lots of talk about the economy, certainly in Washington this week. Obama lobbied for and got Senate approval, which is all that really matters given the political makeup, of the second half of the $700 billion financial rescue package released. He worked hard for that. There was some skepticism. Here's Republican Senator from Alabama, Jeff Sessions, saying he wasn't convinced the new administration would know how to use the money.
I have a vision in my mind of the guy that flew into the hurricane off the Gulf Coast where I live, and he threw out dry ice, and he thought he could cool off the hurricane and stop the hurricane. So now we got the Secretary of Treasury, and he thinks he can get in there and throw this money around and stop the financial hurricane.
Bill McKenzie in Dallas, what do you think? Secretary of Treasury under George Bush certainly wanted that $700 billion, put the hard arm on Congress to get it. Now Barack Obama's got the second half released, but does it look like dry ice on a hurricane to you, Bill?
Well, I'd like to know what Senator Sessions' alternative would be, and I don't know what that is. I think actually President-elect Obama is right to push for this. I will say this is something he and Bush worked on together. I think it is important we do so. I particularly like the fact that a percentage of this money, I forget the amount, is going to be aimed at trying to deal with the foreclosure crisis. Which,
50 to $100 billion out of the 350,
right?
I guess.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, if we dial the clock back, that was at least one of the main reasons we got into this economic situation we're in. So I'm glad for that. It sounds like they're also going to try to really hold the banks more accountable. You know, personally, I would love to see somebody in the government who's dialing up the banks every single day and say, have you loaned any of this money out? You know, there are lots of stories about the banks not loaning the money out. I was talking to a couple friends here yesterday who are lawyers. They're talking about their law firm's lines of credit. So, you know, there are people out there who need money. So the banks need to be using it more than just buying other banks. I'm not saying that's the only thing they've done, but they need to turn some of this money loose. So I hope Obama, I think he's right on this, and I think I hope somebody in the government is really going to be calling these banks each and every day.
Michelle Cottle, of course, they've got to have something to lend that money on that they won't lose money on, or they'll need money that way as well. The bigger package also seems to be getting up on the rails here, $825 billion now. Nancy Pelosi is saying up from the $775 Obama was first talking about. What about the overall big stimulus package? Does it look like it will come on the kind of schedule that Obama was hoping for? Not Jan 20, but maybe that time in February?
Well, Pelosi certainly has threatened to keep everybody in school until she gets this passed. And I think there's some Republicans have expressed their commitment to this as well. And it looks like that the odds are it's going to go up even higher, you know, closer to $900 billion on this. They need this to come in while Obama's got maximum political juice. They need to get this moving fast, and they need to kind of show that they can do something. You know, that's why we have this focus on shovel-ready projects. You know, they need to kind of get in there and get boots on the ground, because if we have another episode like this TARP thing where you throw the money at it and people can't see that something's happening, you're going to be in a heap of trouble.
Let's go to Lewis in Nashville, Tennessee. Lewis, what do you see out there?
John, I'm concerned. I'm a retiree, and I've been a staunch supporter of Obama for the last 2 years. And I saw him as a voice of reason where, you know, he always claimed he would protect the middle class and try to establish a sense of security for the middle class. And I was extremely overjoyed when he was elected. But this morning, I got up and put the TV, and the first thing I heard in the news, the national news, is Obama said that they need to look at the Social Security, and it's not going to be good, and it's going to be painful, and it's going to be people are going to have to give up. Well, I'm not sure he said give up, but said people are going to have to...
But that's the sense you got, that he may have the knife out a bit for Social Security.
Well, yes, but he did say that in the Social Security, he would look at removing the cap on the upper bracket and, you know, taxing that Social Security above a certain income. But
keep high-income workers paying in a little longer. Lewis, our time is short before the break. Let us pick it up. Jack Beatty, here's the rub for Obama. I mean, it's not a joke. It really is a huge economic problem. He said he wants to help the middle class and more, but he's up against a lot here, including the entitlements Lewis is worried about.
He is. I join with Lewis in being disappointed in that. I mean, I don't believe, or I'm convinced by you know, Dean Baker and other economists, that the crisis in Social Security is much overblown, and that any movement that goes to raising the retirement age, if that's what they think is the thing to do, that's going to be at the expense of people like Lewis, people who work for a living, work hard, and should have a little leisure when they can still enjoy it. And as for Medicare, that's a massive public issue that we have to deal with, but I think John McCain raised a good point about Medicare during the campaign when he really talked about means testing Medicare so that you know, upper income people would simply get less of it, and that would save a lot of money. Now, if that's the kind of solution that Obama's willing to talk about, fine. But I would hate to see him, essentially hurt the people who put him into office. He, as Lewis said, he was elected to give greater economic security to people, and cutting these entitlements isn't the way to go.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. Hero on the Hudson this week. Birds apparently hit U.S. Airways Flight 1549. Captain Chesley Sullenberger III, Sully, brought it down safe on the Hudson River. Everybody alive.
This guy was phenomenal.
Because saved our lives.
We were hitting that Hudson River with full impact, and it went boom. And then we stopped.
David Letterman caught President Bush's final press conference.
He admitted, takes a big man to do this, he admitted that a couple of things didn't go according to plan. A couple of things went haywire, yeah, his first term and his second term. Those two things.
Okay, and Ricardo Montalban, Mr. Rourke on ABC's Long Ago Fantasy Island, died this week at 88.
Welcome to Fantasy Island.
Boy, does that seem long ago and far away. We're looking at a week in the news. Bush says farewell, Hillary, and Holder on the Hill. 1,000-plus dead in Gaza. That plane goes down easy in the Hudson River. You can join the conversation. Michelle Cottle's here from the New Republic. Bill McKenzie joins us from Dallas and the Dallas Morning News. Jack Beatty's here. Linda's with us from Warrensburg, New York. Linda, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to say... Even though I didn't vote for Bush after 9/11, I was for him when he went into Afghanistan until he went into Iraq, and then I thought he was delusional. And after listening to him last night, I think he really needs to go into a padded cell when he leaves office. I think Madoff should be put in prison, not stay in his Manhattan apartment, because how many people don't have any retirement now because of them? And those people who gave to charities don't have the money to give to charities.
Linda, I'm with you on Madoff. I have no idea why he's still in a penthouse apartment. Padded cell, I don't know, but we'll see. I mean, Michelle Cottle, Eric Holder said waterboarding is torture. He is very likely to be the next attorney general. What does that mean about this question of whether there may yet be prosecution, looking back on the Bush administration?
Well, they've been very kind of soft about this. They don't want to come out and pledge to investigate anything. I think actually Holder was kind of soft-pedaling the question of what he would be investigating. But I think there's no doubt that there is pressure on them to kind of look into a lot of these memos that were written and things like that. And I think Holder was very clear that he is going to take this in a different direction and making it very clear that they do not approve of what's been going there. There's no question as to whether or not any of this will continue. There's a lot of issues like that and rendition that we'll just kind of, we're turning a page on.
Lots of questions for Hillary Clinton this week, most of them friendly, but tough questions on the foundation of her husband, former President Bill Clinton. There was Indiana Senator Richard Lugar, ranking Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, saying he was concerned by the fundraising activities of Bill Clinton's foundation, said the Clinton Foundation should forswear all foreign donations while Hillary's got the job.
The Clinton Foundation exists as a temptation for any foreign entity or government that believes it could curry favor through a donation. It also sets up potential perception problems with any action taken by the Secretary of State in relation to foreign givers or their countries.
Hillary Clinton argued Bill Clinton's willingness to once a year disclose the donors to the foundation was enough.
I don't know who will be giving money. That will not influence. It will not be in the atmosphere. When the disclosure occurs, obviously it will be after the fact. So it would be hard to make an argument that it influenced anybody because we didn't know about it.
Jack Beatty, what about this one? It's hard for me to see why. I think they've collected a $500 million already, $500 million in the Clinton foundations. Why that wouldn't be enough for him to work with if she's going to be Secretary of State, and just put this question to bed, put it away.
I couldn't agree more. I don't understand why she didn't immediately, you know, say, oh, we're going to do everything. And I guess the reason is she doesn't have to get his vote or anybody else's vote. But it's unseemly to have a president of the United States, a former president of the United States, getting these donations in any case, I think, but especially if his wife is Secretary of State. I mean, it just there has to be an end on this. And at some point, the self-control issue, which has always been so grave for Bill Clinton, has to face up to it and say, enough is enough.
How about the Tim Geithner front? Here he is. He's up for Treasury Secretary. We've got gigantic issues with the economy. I mean, everybody wants to get straight to them. And yet, here are these issues about whether or not he paid his taxes, Jack.
Yeah, and you know what bothers me there is that violates this idea of appointing him violates the John Tower principle, and that principle was established by Sam Nunn in 1990 when the Democrats and I guess I don't know about Republicans, but the Democrats voted down President Bush the first nominee for Secretary of Defense, John Tower, a Texas senator. They voted him down on the grounds that he was an alcoholic, and that in the Pentagon, in the services, if you're an alcoholic, you're discharged. Well. I don't know about the IRS, but I suspect that at the IRS, for which the Treasury is responsible, if you don't pay your taxes on time, and if you seem to be evading taxes, you're discharged. Well, now we have a man who's going to be Obama wants to appoint who didn't pay his taxes on time, who may have evaded paying his taxes, and yet he's going to be put in charge of people who are in charge of taxes. Already the Wall Street Journal, which regards tax evasion as a kind of patriotic act, is pointing to this and saying, now look, fellas, how can you be so demanding of the honest businessman just trying to take a few deductions? I think it's a very, very dubious appointment.
Yeah, but what you've run into here is that nobody wants to come up with an alternative. I mean, you have this guy who's come in that everybody agrees is very smart, and Republicans know that he worked well with the Republican administration when he was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And they do not want to rock the boat on this because they're not going to get a better pick.
Bill McKenzie, time to put up a high ethics bar here or look at the economy and say, let's go.
I'm going to defend Geithner and Hillary on both of this. I think it's kind of a second-tier issue. And what I read of it, it looked like it was some degree of technicality. He went back. He paid it. The Obama people let the Senate Finance Committee know about this. So, you know, I think they've been above board. I mean, the larger issue is, does Geithner have a good idea of how we're going to stimulate this economy? You know, does he know which policy is going to really jumpstart this thing? If we can go back to it just one second, I mean, we're looking at $106 billion in unemployment benefits in the House bill. I can understand that. Reduction in payroll taxes to help people go out and have more money in their pocket. Mm-hmm. I understand that. What I'm having a hard time understanding is how health care benefits through Medicaid are going to help stimulate the economy. I understand how they would be good for states that may be in a problem. I can understand they can help people. I don't see how that stimulates the economy. And I'm having a hard time understanding how building more schools, which I'm in favor of, how that is going to stimulate the economy. So those are the issues that I'm more interested in. Does Geithner have a good idea of how you're going to, you know, create jobs for people in white-collar America and all those, you know, financial houses that have been losing people? Are those really the people who are going to go out there and build the roads? Is the type of worker we're losing really the one who's going to go out and build the roads? And I have a hard time seeing how that's the case. I think Obama's right to try this, but I'm really kind of concerned about what's going to be the tools.
Michelle,
that, to me, is much a bigger issue than whether he paid his taxes.
Michelle, what about it? Shovel ready, but not everybody who's lost a job has been swinging a shovel or will.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the bill is still in flux. I mean, Obama's already dropped those $3,000 employer tax credits, which everybody basically said was going to be just ripe for gaming the system and exploitation. I think infrastructure projects are obviously going to be a big thing, whether it's building roads, improving the electrical grid, or building schools. I mean, obviously people are kind of looking at what their broader priorities are, and education is always an issue. So, you know, we throw building schools in there. It's an infrastructure project. We call it a day. As far as, like, handing out money to the states, part of the thing is if states contract their spending, then all the extra federal government spending is not going to do you all that good. So, you know, you give the money to the states so they're not contracting their spending, and you try to keep things flowing. Obviously, there are a lot of details that are still being hammered out, and that is the big question. You're talking about an enormous amount of money, and the way to spend it is kind of presumably what these giant brains are supposed to be spending their time working on.
We hope. Bill.
One of the ideas I thought Obama had best was to give a tax break to companies for every job they create, and he had it.
But see, that's what all economists said is just not going to work. I mean, that's the one thing that everybody on both sides of the aisle thought, it's just not, and that's why he dropped it, because it's, for one thing, was way too easy to game. So that particular issue was the one thing that everybody said, going to be a disaster, and so he dropped it, which I think shows a certain degree of good flexibility on his point, even if you don't agree with him.
You think that would crank up the economy in Dallas, Bill?
I think it could help, and I agree that it could be gamed. I'm not here to argue it couldn't be, but, I mean, it is something he talked about consistently through the campaign. I just thought it made it is more targeted than some of these that are on the being talked about, which seem to me to be more indirect ways to stimulate the economy. Let's, I agree. We can't do nothing. I completely agree, and I think Republicans are – those Republicans who would think so are wrong – but I just want to make sure we have the right tools.
Let's go to Chris in West Hartford, Connecticut. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Quickly, with respect to Tim Geithner, the question is not does he have know-how and capability, but is he replaceable? Larry Summers would be a very capable replacement who many people think is the smartest mind available in this field.
Doesn't he have his hands full already advising the president on the economy overall? I mean, isn't
he has way too much to do.
Well, the thing is, he doesn't have this tax issue. Tim Geithner did not pay that similar tax with respect to 2001 and 2002, and then only paid that when forced by the Obama transition team.
How about the Clinton Foundation, Tim, Chris? What do you think about the Clinton side of this?
Well, I'm highly frustrated with voices such as Jack railing at the Clintons for raising money from whomever in the world to save people in Africa and other areas with AIDS and malaria. Bill Clinton deserves, arguably, a Nobel Peace Prize. Not all this paranoia that somebody giving him money to help poor people who are suffering with god-awful diseases.
But couldn't $500 million be enough for right now? It's not as though the Clinton Foundation is the only vehicle in the world for that, Chris. Couldn't he kind of just put a cork in the fundraising long enough that there's no suspicion around his wife's role as Secretary of State?
With due respect, Tom, what's the suspicion? The money's not benefiting Bill Clinton personally. The money is saving lives. Millions of people now have AIDS medication who, because of this man's efforts and the people that he's enlisted in his cause.
That is indeed a beautiful thing. But he asks, they give, and, you know, it's human nature to wonder. But, Chris, we've got it. Thank you very much. Let me get another here from Harry in Chester, Vermont. Harry, you're on the air.
Hello,
Harry. You're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Nobody's talking about Afghanistan. By next spring, we'll have 60,000 troops, and I've seen this movie before in Vietnam. What happens when the generals come back and ask for another 50,000, 100,000, 200,000? It's going to cost an enormous amount of money, because once in, it's very hard to get out.
We'll go right to it. Jack, what do you say, Afghanistan and Obama, who's promised to make it, you know, the front?
I'm very worried about it. I think it's the shadow over this hopeful moment. It looks like a completely losing proposition. It's a corrupt government. The idea of salvaging it through some heroic act of nation building, when the president of Afghanistan's brother is a leading drug dealer there. I mean, this looks like a hopeless endeavor. And I would hate to see some of the promise of his presidency disappear in the snows of the Hindu Kush.
Let's go to John. Michelle, please.
Oh, no, I was just going to say Hillary Clinton made it very clear that she sees this as a priority in her hearings. I mean, Petraeus has come out and said they need more troops. I think everybody is aware that this needs to, come up the list of priorities pretty quickly.
We'll be back to Afghanistan, no doubt, again and again. First, John in Littleton, New Hampshire. You're on the air, John.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. How about you?
I'm terrific, thanks. One thing I'd like to bring up is the accountability of this bailout package. I lost my job last year. I now have a new one, but it pays roughly half to 60% of what the other one is.
Ouch.
My wife has a job. We have a mortgage that was, 20 years, and basically it was affordable then. I chose to do that on purpose. But now I'm trying to negotiate with these banks who are getting all this money to give me a 25 or a 30-year mortgage so I can afford it and stay in my home. I'm working, 60 hours a week. I can't do any more. and they won't even talk to you. They won't even help you, and I'm not the only person. There's several people in my community like this. We all have jobs. We all have good credit. We're all working, but there's no accountability. You call these banks, they could care less. They're like, fine, we'll repossess it. They don't care. There's
John, our time is short, but let us get it. Michelle, what do you say? Do you think there's really help on the way here? There was a lot of talk about it before. Finance Committee Chairman Barney Frank said it would be there. It wasn't. I don't know if he got played like a banjo. Will there really be help for homeowners this time?
And they're talking about it again. I mean, and yes, Barney Frank, this is a passion of his. This is one of the things that he most wanted to deal with the TARP bill. There's been some grumbling among Republicans about some of this money and redoing bankruptcy laws to help people who have tough mortgages and stuff like this. But this is, again, one of the things that the Obama people are looking to when they come in, and they've got the Democratic Congress in, you know, that's made this a commitment as well.
Bill McKenzie, President Bush coming home, speaking of homes, to your neck of the woods, Dallas. What can you tell us about the house he's moving into there, his neighborhood? Where is it? What's it like?
Well, it is an area called Preston Hollow, and it is what's interesting to me. He has an 8,000-square-foot house, but it's an area where there are very large estates and what we call McMansions or big hair houses. They don't have that. it is an affluent area. It is not too far from SMU, where his library and institute will be, and it is not far from where they lived before he ran for governor. They have a lot of friends kind of in the area.
Who are the neighbors? Do you know any of them? Who's next door? Or?
Well, next door is the guy he sold the Rangers to, Tom Hicks, who I will point out lives in a quite a much larger place than George Bush.
The baseball team, the Rangers, he sold them, and so now they'll be neighbors. They can watch baseball together.
Exactly.
Well, so. Jack, it sounds like he can survive all right.
Yes. Bill, what are the chances are he'll be out there in Crawford cutting brush?
I think he'll still do it. Said he was going to go down there on weekends. He talked about his institute, said, I don't want this to be the George W. Bush is wonderful center or the George W. Bush campaign tactics. He's talking about already trying to meet with professors, talk about what they can do in various areas to kind of build upon what he has done in terms of the freedom agenda, to work with Mexico, to work on education, to work on immigration, these issues that were part of his agenda, and I would also say perhaps bipartisan part of his agenda.
Any risk of foreclosure there, Bill? Is he pretty well set financially?
I don't think that's the risk.
Well, sell the Rangers and you'll be all right. William McKenzie, Bill McKenzie at the Dallas Morning News in the Oval Office with President Bush just last week. Bill McKenzie, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you all.
Michelle Cottle, Senior Editor at the New Republic. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us today, Michelle.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty and everybody else out there, stay warm, Jack. Hope your nose doesn't get frostbite up in New Hampshire.
20 below up here, Tom.
Woo-hoo, it was 19 below. My dad set out at the barn in Illinois this morning.
Oh,
it's cold
gosh.
All over the world. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.